A lot of people love Yes Right. A lot
Yes.
of people loathe
You're
Yes
not
Right.
among those,
No,
are you?
no, two or three that Bruce and I didn't care for. But anyway, I think Ken put that in just to give me the heebie-jeebies. But here's our very special guest as I shout author, author, and introduce Peter Philip. Good evening,
G'day,
Peter.
G'day, Philip. Lovely to be on the show with you, Kevin, and also Simon.
Nice to meet you.
Now, of course, we see each other at the Survivor's Lunch twice a year, which is a delight. But first of all, tell us something about your colourful radio career.
Oh, well, I don't know how colourful it was, Philip. I was very lucky. I always been a bit of a 3KZ fan when I was a kid. My I lived with my grandmother, and she was a mad KZ. Loved Norman Banks. So we listened to 3KZ, and I can always remember listening in at, we'd have the Argus News at 7, then someone from the Trades Hall for 5 minutes, and then at 7.15, probably John Ford, you know, 3KZ, the Brighter Broadcasting Service, the time is 7.15, and then the Darrod's theme, Darrod's The Style Store presents Office Wife. Or Dossier on Demetrius.
Or Convict Girl.
Or Convict Girl, yes.
Yeah.
So I got very friendly with Stan Rofe. And Rofe, he said to me one time, he said, look, Peter, he said, there's a guy leaving, Alan Roberts, who's a panel operator, is leaving. And in a fortnight's time, they'll be advertising the job. And he said, there will be a queue from 64 Elizabeth Street down past Flinders Street Station. If you get in first, go and see Keith Bullman, use my name, and I reckon you'll get the job. So I was just delighted, went along, and Keith Bullman tried to talk me out of it. He said, oh, don't go into radio. And so I got into KZ as a panel operator, and I was lucky enough to work with my hero. Well, Stan Rofe was a great hero of mine, but Norman Swain. What a wonderful entertainer.
Wonderful.
What a fabulous human being.
Yes.
Because the Norman Swain, the human being, was just as good as the man on air. And I work with him on the morning shows and the last of Billy Bouncer in the afternoon. Just wonderful.
Right. Would have been Benny Lum as well, wouldn't it?
No, Benny had gone. He was doing it by himself for a while. And then he had, I think, June Gardner, because a soft drink company started to sponsor it, and she was the agency person. But we used to, he used to record, the only thing he recorded was Once Upon a Time, The Folk of the Faraway Tree or The Wishing Chair. And we would go in to the big auditorium at 3KZ, number 2 studio, and eat our lunch and just watch him sitting at the desk doing The Faraway Tree. He was extraordinary.
Doing all the voices.
All the sound. He didn't use, he didn't have sound effects. He had the train. He had all the voices. Oh. And he was just an entertainer to watch.
Yes.
So we sat there watching The Faraway Tree.
I used to get dressed to get ready for school and listen to all that. But Bruce Mansfield was also there at that time.
Bruce came later in the piece, just before I left. A wonderful ex-3AW guy, Keith McGowan, left 3TR Sale, and Lee Murray, who taught me and I think taught you and taught most other people in the industry, said, I think it's time to move from KZ. And so Bruce had just started, and I went to Sale. So I worked with Bruce for probably 12 months.
Okay. And the coincidence is, as I discovered, Peter, at the Survivor's Lunch, was the three of us auditioned for Channel 9 at Easter 1958. The three booth announcers who auditioned, as far as I know, were Barry Ferber, Peter Philp, and Philip Brady. Is that true?
I can't remember. That's going back. I don't know whether I was part of that, but I know I was at Sale from 62 to 67. Then I went to GLV10, Gippsland Television, then back to KZ, 3KZ, as a journalist, and I did Saturday and Sunday breakfast, which was a big thing. You'd start at 5 on breakfast, and then at 9 till 2 you'd read news, and by the time you're 2 o'clock you had really had it.
And were you still at the Trades Hall in those days?
We were. The wonderful Trades Hall, where Murka the Mouse used to live and Reggie Rat, and on the roof Uncle Norman kept his jet bomber.
Oh, yes.
Which, in fact, was an old vacuum cleaner.
Oh, great memories.
Oh, wonderful stuff. I work with Jim Archer, the late Jim Archer. He was a great guy. Jeff Brook, Philip Gibbs was still calling football in those days.
Yes.
And, of course, that wonderful breakfast man, Ron Cady.
Oh, yes.
Ron was always late, and I'd be saying a little Hail Mary that he'd always be late because you'd get on the air.
Oh,
and
yes.
Ron would come in and he'd say, do you want me to go to the control room for a while and let you continue on?
Oh, very generous performer.
Ron was another absolutely great guy, talented guy, could sing, play the piano, and They were a great learning team to work with.
And, of course, that's where your love of cereals would have begun.
Well, KZ, we still had Darrards on, and we had the drama of medicine on a Sunday night. But I think when I got very close to the cereals, apart from being a kid and loving them, I got very close to the cereals when I worked at 3TR Sale, because when I went from KZ to 3TR, they had cereals morning, noon and night.
Ah.
And I used to listen to them and think, there's a lot more depth. Even Dr. Paul, you'd listen to that. The production was just wonderful. Yeah. Alistair Duncan and Dinah Shearing in the starring roles. Mm. Great stuff. And Lyndall Barber at 10:15 in Portia Faces Life.
Yeah.
Now, they were simple romantic stories, but the production, the artistic value was great because you could close your eyes and you could see Portia.
Well, those radio actors, they were world-class, weren't they?
They were.
Probably the best in the world.
The best in the world. I don't think anyone would deny that. And people like Harp Maguire came from America. He was quite a big actor in America.
Mm.
He came to work here. Joe McCormick came from Canada. A lot of actors came from England. And they discovered that where they would have 1 or 2 days to rehearse and to gradually move into the character. These characters in Australia were doing 5 or 6 characters in a day.
Perhaps unrehearsed.
The overseas people was a nightmare to them. They couldn't do it.
Yeah, a lot of the serials were not even rehearsed. They just flew them.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
By the seat of their pants.
Exactly right.
I would say a lot of these shows were based on American radio shows, and were they adapted to the Australian environment?
Well, that's true. Probably, you could say almost from 1940... right through to the end, probably almost 100% of Australian drama was Australian. Now, you're right, Kevin. There were lots of very popular American shows like Hop Harrigan, Biggles, When a Girl Marries, Portia. They're all American scripts. We would buy the scripts and we would bring them out here. And as Enid Lorimer, who was Dr. Mack's wife in the series, the old Edith Lorimer, she said, we had to translate the American stuff into English.
Yes.
So it was all redone for Australian people.
I believe Superman was like that too, and they reworked the scripts.
It was a big American serial, but it was redone here.
Mm.
But the interesting thing, guys, was that around about 1935, the Americans, because they had so many stations, they would produce all these serials in America, and they would make all their money in America. So then they would flood South Africa, New Zealand and Australia. And you could buy the serials for about 5 shillings an episode. Now, the executives on the stations loved this because they were getting all the American stuff virtually for nothing. Two things happened. There were some very talented people in the wings like George Edwards, Edward Howe in Melbourne, Lee Murray, Mayne Linton, who were very talented, creative guys who ended up saying, we can do a better job than the Americans. Executives saying, oh, no, we can't afford Australian productions. The final straw was when the Australian audience said, we only want Australians. So the big, like the General Motors Hour, that was every fortnight came from America. Lux every fortnight came from America with film stars. In the end, the audience dropped when the Americans were on the air, and so the whole thing became Australian. So this big, we call the American invasion, collapsed, and American radio was never a threat again. Australian audiences loved Australian stuff.
Were we taking much stuff from the BBC?
Not commercially. The ABC were taking a lot. So virtually 100% from 19... Well, once Dad and Dave came, Dad and Dave really changed the scene because, one, it could be done on disc. We went to these big transcriptions and started the label and worked out to the side, a trap for young players. Once the discs came out and George Edwards did it, he won the Australian audience. That's all they wanted. So then came Martin's Corner, When a Girl Marries, all this stuff, even though some of them were written in America, although Dad and Dave, of course, was written by a guy called Morris Francis. He could just sit down at a typewriter and he would have 3 or 4 stenographers and he would be doing a bit of Dad and Dave, a bit of another, he'd be a First Light Fraser. He's doing about 5 serials on the go with 5 different stenographers taking it down. They were just geniuses, these people.
Were there any Australian productions that didn't work? One that immediately springs to mind, I was listening earlier, putting some grabs in the system that we could use tonight, and I found an Australian episode of Dragnet. And it didn't have that, dun, 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 and it didn't have Jack Webb.
No,
Jack Webb, yes.
Well, actually, there was a it was a successful serial outhead. Grace Gibson did it, and it was produced by the guy they call the Orson Welles of Australian radio, a guy called Reg Johnston.
Yes,
Johnston was the guy that put Dossier and Demetrius on the road. He worked out in just jumping here a little bit. He worked out the theme he used was conflict and destruction. Da 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 da. Dossier and Demetrius, and he thought, I'm going to get someone to whistle that. So actually the whistle came from the tune. Now, he did Dragnet, and I, not that I heard much of the American one, but I think the Australian one was probably better.
Okay.
And who was in the Australian one?
It ran for a couple of years.
Who played Jack Webb in Australia?
I'm trying to think. It'll be in the famous book here.
Someone like Hart McGuire.
But no, it wasn't. No, it was an Australian that played.
Not Guy Dolman.
No, it wasn't Guy Dolman. But I tell you who played his offsider was Joe McCormick.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the Canadian with a very rough voice.
Oh, yes.
He did Buckley's Canadian Mixture. Remember that?
Oh, yes. Hey, you even know the themes to all these serials. You're amazing.
They were tantalising. I remember at KZ, people would ring up and say, what's the name of your news theme? What's the name of the theme you use for Dossier and Demetrius, because they got 15 seconds of it. And because they're on a special Chapel record or Boosie and Hook, people couldn't buy them. Drove them mad.
One of the scariest was on EMI called Sword of Damocles. You'd probably know that. A really frightening intro, that one. But we mentioned...
Sorry if I can interrupt, Phil, just looking through the fabulous book, Drama in the Drama in Silent Rooms by Peter Philp. Peter Philp writes, in the States, Dragnet was playing on a network of 166 stations each Thursday night at 8:30. The scripts were written by James E. Moser and starred Jack Webb. The first of the Australian series of Dragnet was called The Big Revenge, supporting Frank Walkers and Waters.
Frank Waters.
Sorry, I can't read. And Joe McCormick in this episode were Paul McNaughton, Al Garcia, Kerry Norton, Alan White, Ron Whelan, and Owen Ainley. So it was Frank Waters.
Frank Waters, he played.
Like Joe Friday.
You might remember Frank, born in Broken Hill, but he had a very gruff voice.
No.
And that's something else, Philip and guys, that I think... we don't appreciate is that Australian radio actors had an unusual accent. They didn't have the Australian drawl. And when you listen to people like Bruce Stewart or Keith Eden or John Morgan, you'd say, not British, not American, not Canadian. What is it? It's an international accent. People used to say the late John Ford, who was on UZ and KZ, had a mid-Pacific. I think we almost had the mid-Pacific accent.
Yes.
So they could play anywhere. When they went to England, they were in great demand because they weren't Americans.
That's right. Or what was called the transatlantic accent.
Exactly.
John Ford, of course, was Canadian originally.
Yes, he was.
As you'd well know.
Yes.
And now, 25 years researching the book, you were just a teenager when you started.
You're very kind, Philip. No, it was a long time. Naturally, I still had to feed myself and my family, so it wasn't full-time work, but it was constant going because there was nothing there. There was no books written on it. Richard Lane did a fine book a few years ago, but it was more of an encyclopedia.
You
could look up. Mm. And he also, once he did the name and where they were born and a whole list of serials, he didn't say much about the serials. He got into their theatre work. Now, that's fine, but no one had ever done anything purely on radio.
And many of the characters he talked of were from Sydney anyway.
Exactly.
It's a very Sydney-centric book.
And we had probably three of the best actors ever to play on Australian radio. Richard Davies.
Yes.
Douglas Kelly and Clifford Cowley.
Yes.
Magnificent actors.
I remember seeing Clifford Cowley in front of a microphone with a walking stick and walking with a limp.
Yes.
Are you aware of that?
He wasn't very well.
Maybe it was a war
injury.
Look,
this is the history, so you've got to be honest. He went through very sad times towards the end of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And the late Hector Crawford was a bit of a saviour for him.
Oh, that's good.
Hector was very good. People think, oh, tough businessman, which he was, but I think he was also a great human being.
Now, here's Vicky, who'd like to say hello to you, Peter, and she's in Central Victoria. Hello, Vicky.
Hello, Vicky.
Yeah, where is she? Line two?
The phone's up, but it's not working properly.
Try again, Dickie. Maybe call back and we'd love to talk to you. Is it true that some of these actors, because they were working under pressure, became alcoholics?
Oh, well, yes, there were. There were. I mean, there were no drugs in those days. Yes, there were. And the three actors I've mentioned, Davies, Kelly, and also Cowley, they were alcoholics, but they still had the art. You know, there's a beautiful story told about Clifford Cowley. The actors were very worried about him because he's on his stick and he wasn't well, he was falling over. And somebody, Keith Eden or John Morgan, said, "We're worried about you, Cliff. Have you had breakfast this morning?" "Oh, don't worry, guys. I've had breakfast. I've been down to the Phoenix and I've had three brandies already."
Oh, but I always had one before 10.
But he could still stand at that microphone, and only those people around him knew that he was that he'd been drinking.
Yeah.
They had this wonderful art of being the great one of the great actors actually collapsed during a show, so they pull the microphone down and put it on the floor, and off he continued to do it.
Oh, you're kidding!
Robert Bernard, remember Robert?
Oh, yeah,
Bernard?
Big man, wasn't
big,
he?
Great, big guy.
Yeah,
yes,
great
yes.
voice.
Yes, yes.
Oh, very deep voice.
Yes.
Now we'll give it another crack and see if we can talk to Vicky. How are you there, Vicky?
G'day. How are you?
I'm good. How about yourself?
Oh, yeah, not too shabby. I'm just ringing to say how a wonderful show you have.
It's a great show, isn't it? I can say that because it's not my show, but these guys have really brought magic back into radio.
Yeah, because I remember back when we had our first family sedan, the FJ, and everybody had the 3UZ is football.
Yes.
Do you remember them?
Uh-huh. Yeah, three. I think you mean 3KZ was football with Ian Major, old Jack Dyer. Remember that?
Yes. And I'm just saying just how wonderful the program is and bringing back all the good voices.
Yeah.
And it's just a wonderful show. I'm in the bush, Central Victoria, at the moment.
Well, good on you, Vicky. Lovely call. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Obviously, I'm a bit nervous.
No, you've done well. And ring more often.
I think we're coming through KLFM in Maryborough.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, and, I'm nervous. Bye-bye.
No, don't worry. You've done well. Hey, Peter Philp, did you have a favourite cereal through the years?
I did. I think the Gregory Keane, the first three Gregory Keanes were my favourite.
And Dossier, there were five, weren't there?
There were five. Donovan Joyce and Lindsay Hardy was the author, and he and Donovan Joyce were thick as thieves. Mm. And Donovan Joyce gave Lindsay his first break, and he did that famous Office Wife. That was his second serial. And then he came in, they used to drink at the back bar of the London Hotel, corner of Elizabeth and Collins, the famous London.
Uh-huh.
And Hardy came in and said, "Look, I've got the best serial that's ever been written." And Joyce had a look at the script. He said, "It's pretty good, isn't it?" "Yeah, yeah." But he said, "It lacks something, Lindsay." And Lindsay said, "What?" He said, "Not enough sex in it." Now, keep in mind that in 1949, sex was, you know, taboo. We couldn't say, in our early days, Philip, couldn't say damn on the air.
That's true.
So what Joyce was saying, we have to have a little innuendo. Mm. We've got to have more romance. Anyway, Hardy says, "No, I've done the thing. I'm going to keep it." "No," says Joyce, "you've got to change it." So they were both very stubborn people. So Joyce thought, well, tomorrow Hardy needs the job. He'll come back and he'll have romance in it. And what did Hardy do? He rang up Grace Gibson. And within 24 hours, up there at Menzies Hotel, selling Dossier on Demetrius.
Oh,
that's legendary.
But there was some sex from Hardy, wasn't there?
Oh, yes, yes. But have you ever read the book Dossier on Demetrius called Requiem for a Redhead?
No, I have not.
Well, in that, Gregory Keane's actually sleeping with Hetty.
Oh, no, yes. Don't tell me.
My word.
What a shock. Horror.
So what you did in books, that's a good book to read. If you like Dossier on Demetrius, go on the line and see if you can get Requiem for a Redhead, Gregory Keane.
Okay, at the moment, Golden Age Radio are replaying Road to Samara.
Well, now, when Hardy went to Hollywood and had great success in Hollywood, Joyce brought him back and said, "Right, you're going to write for me." And so he did Two Roads to Samara, The Smell of Terror. He did that wonderful show called Mask of Alexis with James Condon.
Yeah.
He did Stranger in Paradise with Guy Dolman. Because Hardy's hero in broadcasting was Guy Dolman.
Oh, yes.
Because it really, Guy Dolman was the star of Dossier.
Yes.
Gregory Keane, of course, was the good.
I agree, yes.
And there was a big fight between he and Grace Gibson because he didn't want Demetrius to be killed. Mm. He wanted Demetrius to live on.
Go on.
And Grace Gibson said, you've got to kill the villain.
Yes,
Peter,
absolutely.
Your book is called Drama in the Silent Rooms. Now, I believe the actors would stand around the microphone and rather than rustle paper, they would drop the sheets onto the floor there was no sound. Is that the way it worked?
Exactly, exactly. And they were so good because some of the sound effects were done in a booth. Off records, but some were done live. Like shutting the door was always done live.
Mm.
Knocking the door, the fighting, the walking.
Yeah.
When Joe McCormick did Gun Smoke, and he wasn't Matt Dillon, he was Matt Morgan. They actually put a big gravel tray, especially in the Art Transit studios for him, and half the serial, they said, McCormick just walked up and down, muttering to himself.
Wonderful.
But it was just a wonderful, wonderful show, Gunsmoke.
Yeah.
So, yes, they did their own sound effects. They were very clever with their the way they could just come in and come back and to the microphone. So if you weren't in for a while, you could drift back and then drift in again. Just incredible the way they did it.
Too bad if you dropped your page and you hadn't read it yet. You had to bend down and pick it back up again.
I was thinking the same thing. You wouldn't want to drop the wrong page. Yeah,
or the whole script.
Especially toward the end of the serial.
But they worked so well together that if some accident happened, and sometimes they, you know, the guy that was doing a minor role might have the fifth carbon. We didn't have computers.
Yes.
So we had blue carbon paper and it was very difficult to read. So he'd have to, particularly in some of the George Edward shows, he'd virtually have to ad lib.
Oh, how wonderful.
But they knew the cue was coming up. And then they'd get the stretch because some of Maurice Francis's serials ran short.
Oh.
And so the producer would put his fingers up and stretch. So they would actually ad lib a lot of them. Like When a Girl Marries, the producer would come sometimes into the studio and say, oh, by the way, when you're going down the street, would you buy... And suddenly this would be a whole new part of the serial
amazing.
It out because they had to finish at 12 minutes and 30 seconds.
And of course, most of these early serials went on to acetate recordings.
Yes.
And any fluff, any mistake, any errors, they'd have to go back and start all over again.
And that would cause chaos in Sydney because you'd be booked into Grace Gibson at 9, AWA at 10, Macquarie at 11, 12 o'clock. ABC, and then you go to Homebush to HMV or Columbia, George Edward. Now, if someone made a mistake, that meant a whole hour was lost, and so the whole of Sydney would fall into chaos because everyone else would be thrown out. You know, they said one day they rarely picked new actors. You had to be excellent. Good enough. Good wasn't good enough. So one actor made a mistake. And it came to a part where somebody said, see that man over there? He's exposing himself. It was in the script. So everyone broke up. So that meant they had to start again. When they got to the same spot again, they hadn't changed the script. They broke up again. So this was at AWA. So all the other studios were out for 2 days because of this mistake at AWA.
Oh, it delayed everybody.
Yeah, it delayed everyone.
We need to take a break. Jeff, John, Tony will come and get your calls in a moment. Our special guest this hour, Peter Philp, author of Drama in Silent Rooms. I also want to find out about when the recording actually started and did we have serials before that had to be performed live. We'll find out about that in a couple of minutes.
The Aspro Short Story. Thumbnail sketches from life.
And, of course, the voice of Roland Strong.
Yes, Peter Philp, our special guest. Now, Peter, I have to know, 3AW first went to air back in 1932, February the 22nd. Mm-hmm. On that evening, I think it was the Mayor or Lord Mayor of Melbourne gave a big speech. The station officially opened. They then crossed to J.C. Williamson's Imperial Grand Opera performing a show. And then after that, they actually simulcast a show that was playing at the theatre that evening at His Majesty's, The Chocolate Soldier. So I'm assuming, was that sort of before recordings existed?
Recordings, really, Dad and Dave was the... the first to bring in recordings because Columbia was owned by EMI, or the Gramophone Company, his master's voice as well. So they were the first to come out on those great big 16-inch transcriptions. Now, they weren't vinyl as later ones were. They were actually...
the acetate?
No, not acetate. No. Like the old 78s. You dropped them on the floor, you broke them.
They shatter.
Shellac.
Shellac is the word. And they started on from the label and they went from the inside now to the outside. Now, the reason for that was in those days, of course, you only had steel needles. Now, they say the steel needle, you could get away with playing two 78s and then you'd blunt it.
Yes.
So these things ran for 12 minutes, 30 seconds. So by the time the needle got to the label, it was blunt and it started to distort.
Oh, yes.
So the closer you get to the label, the swing, the quality deteriorates. The best quality is on the outside.
Yes.
So they used to use the worst part of the disc, the best part of the needle.
Yep.
So by the time it got to the outside, when the needle was blunting, you had the bigger swing.
Isn't that
the
clever?
Quality.
That's so clever.
However, for young guys working in country radio, they'd put on an episode, say an early episode of Superman, and they'd try and cue it up on the beginning and keep jumping off. And they'd think, gee, what's wrong with this record? Because it was the end. And so,
Now, from memory, Peter Philp, an author of Drama in the Silent Rooms, will tell you how to purchase it later. It's one of the best books I have read in years. But I think, yes, what originally was live to air in Adelaide before they started recording it.
5AD did it all, and yes, they did it live, and they deliberately didn't publicise themselves because Wackador, Rex Dorr, who was Dr. Pym,
yes.
he was a lawyer, and so he didn't really want to have his name associated with this carry-on. But then, of course, when he went to Sydney, he became a big name in Colgate-Palmolive.
Yes.
But, incredible show because I'm sure somewhere in Australia it's being played today.
Yes, yes. And, of course, all the cast, or many of them, went away to war in 1939. Did they regroup after
they
the war?
They tried to do it in Sydney, and it was never a success because they went to AWA because Biggles also started in Adelaide at 5AD.
Oh, true.
And Rex Walden. X3AW.
Yes.
He was
and
the first.
So the story goes.
So the story goes.
A voice.
And then when he was dismissed, I believe his last show was "And So the Announcer Goes."
Oh, how appropriate.
So Rex Walden was the first Biggles. So these two serials began in Adelaide, but of course, when Biggles, the second series, came to Sydney, it was a great success.
Maurie Powell. Yeah, yeah.
Played never Biggles. Been an aeroplane in his life. played Biggles, whereas Yes What never picked up, and many years later, over in London, they did another version with again Rex Wackador as Dr. Pym. It was called Dr. Pym's Progress. And John Casabon played one of the people, but it was a bit of a failure. So the original Adelaide one was the famous.
The first Biggles was the Pearls of Vanakkai, and they used the Superman theme rather than the Biggles theme in the first series. Tell me, Peter, talk about the actors, the radio actors who went to Hollywood. Some became really big names.
Well, Ron Randall was probably the first. Ron Randall was the first... Harry in When a Girl Marries. He went to America and he frequently came back. And when I met him, I thought, here's this big Hollywood actor. He won't want to talk about radio. He said, Peter, this was one of the most delightful times of my life. Oh. He said, I loved working in radio drama. Oh. And he said, I never, ever put down When a Girl Marries. He said, because I enjoyed doing that. And he said, we still did the same performance as if we were doing a classical play for the ABC.
Yeah, well, that was his bread and butter, too.
Exactly. The other one, of course, was Rod Taylor, who won the Roller. Remember Roller loudspeakers?
Yes.
Well, they did a thing called the Roller Show.
That's right.
And there was a prize at the end of the year. And one of the winners was Rod Taylor. And he won a trip to London. And the actor said, come on, Rod, I think you can talk to the agency who was sponsoring it. You need to go to Hollywood, mate. So they sent him to Hollywood, and, of course, he never came back.
The role of the factory was near Channel 9 in Westgate.
In Richmond.
West Bank Terrace. Yeah. Some calls for you, Peter Philp, author of these wonderful old radio serials. Well, the author of Drama in Silent Rooms, telling the story of the radio serials. Hello, Jeff.
Oh, g'day there, guys. Look, not being a fan of the cricket, I was sitting in front of the computer and queued you up on the webcam there. And I must say, Peter, I've got to apologise because I didn't know who you were. But
No one knows me, Jeff.
I've got to say, though, if I hadn't been watching on the screen, I would have sworn you were sitting there with heaps of reference material in front of you because your knowledge of everything was just incredible. Mm. And I rang up and I said to Ken, I said, who's this guy sitting to the left of Simon? I said, what doesn't he know? And as Ken said, he's been around forever and he knows absolutely everything there is. So I just thought I'll just go on air and say to you guys, it's just magnificent to listen to and really enjoy it. I mean, I've been a fan of my introduction, I suppose, to some of the serial and stuff with Keith McGowan, you know, over a long period of time when he was doing nights. And so I just thought I'd just wait on just to say how much I'm enjoying it. And I marvel at your knowledge of things and your recall of stuff. It's unbelievable.
Well, look, I have a bit of a passion, I think, like Philip and a number of other people. This was the highlight of Australian entertainment. We've always followed a little bit in film and even in television. Our stage probably has never been as big as London, but radio was the biggest in the world. Mm. We didn't produce as many as America, but quality-wise, we probably had the best product, and certainly we had the best actor. America used film stars, and film stars are not radio actors.
Sure.
There's a lovely story told about On the Beach. Stanley Kramer got all the cast together one day and he said, there's something wrong with the dialogue, people. We've got to change it. And he said, we're going to sit around the table and we're just going to read the script. And anyway, they all went around. There was Ava Gardner and
Gregory Peck
and
Fred Astaire
and Psycho.
Anthony Perkins.
Anyway, when it came to Gregory Peck's time, he sat down there and he read the script. And Keith Eden and Guy Dolman were sitting on the other side of the table. And Eden turned around to Dolman and said, tell you what, you'd never get into radio. Because it's a different medium. Now, it's not putting Gregory Peck down.
Yes.
But the visual medium is different to the sound.
Mm. Yeah, very much.
The sound was everything.
Yeah, very perceptive of you, Jeff. Thanks for your call.
You can't see someone raising an eyebrow on radio.
No, or kick your leg up in the air.
Yeah, exactly. John's at Burnside. Hello, John.
Good evening, gentlemen. Love your show.
Yes, hello to Peter Philp.
You're bringing about lots of great memories of sitting around the kitchen table pre-TV listening to all the radio serials.
Weren't they wonderful?
They were indeed. Another time. I just wanted to ask, Simon last week was talking about restoring all these recordings. I wondered if you had any wire recordings still.
No. In fact, wire had gone out before I got into radio. We were lucky to have tape in my early...
I used to be an electrician at Station Pier back in the 1950s, early 1950s. And the great Norman Banks used to come down and interview people.
The voice of
the voyager. Yes, he'd often go on board a ship going up the rope ladder as it came through the heads.
That's right.
True, yes.
Wonderful. What a great performer, Norman Banks.
Yeah, well, you remember, of course, in those days everybody travelled by sea.
Yeah.
And celebrities came to Australia by sea, and Norman Banks would turn up to interview them.
That's right, on Sunday night, 7:30, The Voice of the Voyager.
That's
with
one,
Norman Banks as the man on deck.
We used to lend him a corner of our electrical switch room on the pier to sit down and interview his visitors, and I'm sure he had a wire recorder back in those
days.
Yes,
look, he would have had a wire recorder, but...
And I'm talking 1951 or 2003, maybe.
Yes, well, wow. I'm a sort of a 59 guy. When did you break in, Philip?
58 was 58. My first year, yeah. Mm. Interesting story, John. Thank you very much. And I presume with Y, if it snapped, could they sort of knot it together again and keep going?
No.
What was the story, Simon?
My understanding is that they couldn't. If it broke, that was it. Recording was lost.
Oh, really?
And the only reason I say that, my one bit of knowledge or my one reference in my life to a wire recording came from a story of Uncle Jeff. My uncle was Jeff Cork.
Oh, Corky.
Now, Uncle Jeff told the story of going to the airport when Frank Sinatra arrived. And all these reporters were all around, and he's there thinking, how on earth am I going to get an interview with Frank Sinatra? And he got a flower, and he took it up to Mr. Sinatra and said, Mr. Sinatra, this is for your wife. And Frank was impressed by that, something novel, something different. So he invited Uncle Jeff to jump in the car with him, with his wire recorder, and he interviewed him on the way from the airport to the hotel. Uncle Jeff was, I think, on 3DB at the time, would it have been, Phil? Yeah, so gets there. Thank you very much, Mr. Sinatra. And he's thrilled he's got this exclusive. And yet, as it turns out, the wire broke. Mm. Never got to air.
Oh, sadly.
Shame.
It could have been a complete and utter lie.
No, it sounds good. Hey, Tony's in Castlemaine, probably listening through KLFM. Hi, Tony.
Hi.
Speak to Peter Philp.
Hello, Peter.
How are you, Tony?
Not bad, thank you. I'm just been trying to recall some of the serials I used to listen to as a kid in New Zealand in the late 50s and through the 60s. Biggles, I certainly remember.
Hop Harrigan, would you have heard that one?
I'm not sure. That doesn't ring a bell. 4 o'clock every afternoon was The Archers, which I'm told was an English play.
Yes, it was. Yes. It was.
Very similar to, it has a similar history to Blue Hills and the Lawsons. They were looking for a rural program to dramatise in the same way as they did Dick Barton. Somebody said, let's do a farming program with the same drama as Dick Barton. So that's how The Archers began.
Yes.
And, of course, we actually had the Lawsons before that.
Yes.
As part of the Country Hour.
Oh, interesting, Tony. How long have you been in Australia now?
Oh, since 1980.
Okay.
Tony, we Australians always claim New Zealanders to be Australians, but some of our best radio actors that we claim were Australians were actually New Zealanders. Lloyd Burrell, Guy Dolman, and the fabulous Bruce Stewart that played Gregory Keane. So a lot of good New Zealanders came to Australia.
Wonderful.
I was just thinking, was there one... It was something about Dexter. Was it Life with
Dexter? Willie Fennell.
There you are. Tony, anything else you want to ask?
This is something that has always stuck in my mind. At the end of many of these serials, there'd be a bloke with a very dramatic voice, and he'd say, you have been listening to a Grey Gibson production.
Ah, wonderful.
And I often wondered, how would a person have a first name of Grey?
No, Grace, as in Grace Kelly.
Yeah, I figured that
one of the great,
a few years.
Yeah. One of the great radio studios, still going today. Bruce Ferrier runs it.
I've seen a couple of
times. We'll talk about Grace Gibson after 10. Anything else, Tony?
No, I think that covers it.
Yeah, right. And I want to talk to you about Grace Gibson. I want to talk to you about George Edwards and his wife, Nell Sterling. I have a million questions. Yeah. Are you free to stay on after the news? Kevin, will you stay back?
Certainly.
Simon, will you stay back?
If I must. News is coming up in about a minute and a half. After the news, we will continue our chat with Peter Philp because we've barely scratched the surface. He's done so much work. And I have to say, guys, one thing that impressed me, because this is the first time tonight I've clapped eyes on the book, Peter. We used to have a studio manager here at 3AW in the very early days. In fact, he was on air on 3AW on the opening night with Jack O'Hagan and Vernon Sellers, who was was 3AW's first breakfast host. His name was E. Mason Wood, and I thought, I wonder, because I knew he sort of went into serials, so I had a quick flick through to the index. And thought, I wonder if E. Mason Wood gets a mention. Yeah, 53 times.
Yeah, and Lawrence H. Cecil and all those people who produced the Caltechs. It's going to be wonderful. Peter, will continue the talk after the news, and I repeat what I said earlier. Drama in Silent Rooms, one of the best books to have come out in years. It makes a wonderful Christmas present.
Motor Oil, over a network of 69 stations throughout Australia, presents Leave It to the Girls with Terry Dear.
Let's leave it to the girls. Let's leave it to the girls. If you've a problem puzzling you and you don't know just what to do, ask Terry Dear to help you.
Night Beat.
Hi there. This is Randy Stone. I cover the Night Beat for the Daily. Stories start in many different ways. This one began on the main highway and ended at the foot of a cliff.
Night Beat, starring Hop McGuire as Randy Stone. Before we begin tonight's story, here's your announcer.
May we have your company for the next half hour or so. Start to smile as you check the time. It's the Cadbury Show.
Cadbury's makers of famous dairy milk chocolate bring you another edition of the Cadbury Show, broadcast on a network of 46 stations throughout Australia.
Take it from here, go Norway when you can take it from here. Why don't you stay and maybe join in the fun now the show has begun.
Yes, Dick Bentley and Jimmy Edwards will be on hand for the next 30 minutes with June Whitfield, Wallace Eaton and the Keynotes, all inviting you to...
Take it from me.
This is Henry Simon, bringing you another story from my files here at the Missing Persons Bureau.
In these stories of the Missing Persons Bureau, dramatized for Henry Simon by Ross Napier, names and addresses have, for obvious reasons, been changed.
Favorite show. Now's the time for answers to things you want to know.
Johnson & Johnson, makers of Johnson's Baby Powder, the famous tech toothbrush and Band-Aid adhesive bandages, welcome listeners on 57 stations throughout Australia
to the Quiz Kids Show.
Well, folks, we're in company with Peter Philp, who is the author of Drama in Silent Rooms, a history of radio drama in Australia from the 1920s to the 1970s. Now, Peter, for people who have just tuned in, we'll tell them later how to purchase this book. I think it's over 600 pages thick. And let me just tell you, and this is the truth.
Please don't call him thick. That's dreadfully rude to talk to a guest that way.
This book is so good, I have already purchased 13 copies for Christmas giving, which you've kindly signed. And are you aware, boys, Kevin and Simon, that Peter's come all the way from Fish Creek to be with us tonight, a three-hour drive to be on air live with us when we could have done it over the phone? You've paid us a great compliment, Peter.
Well, it's lovely to be here because I had not seen the new 3AW studios, and they're beautiful, aren't they?
How long since you've been on the air?
Well, I do a community radio show every month with Ray Lawrence, who's an old 3AW man.
A friend of ours.
We do documentaries and we do a lot of history, and Ray plays a lot of Les Elgart and Ray Conniff.
Yes.
Because he's a great debutee of the late Tony Charlton.
Yes.
So we do that every month, the first Wednesday of every month.
Well done.
Okay. You've come all this way and all we're giving you is a lousy cup of tea, aren't we? Aren't we great?
No, but later you are going to get a chocolate wheaten biscuit.
Oh.
And maybe a banana. And also, do you smoke?
Now, Peter, in terms of, because I wasn't born until 1971, radio drama wasn't really sort of in my life. The closest I come to it is listening to Blackers and Unca do Story Time on 3AW in the 1980s. And Gavin Wood and Molly Meldrum did a version of Batman and Robin twice a week. So that's sort of as close as I ever came as a child to listening to radio drama. But having worked with Bruce and Phil for 20 years on this show, one of the absolute highlights of my life was the joy of meeting Smokey Dawson, who I just thought was wonderful. And I've since listened to, you know, the occasional episode of Smokey Dawson as I've found it. And, gee, he was good.
He was good. And Ken Wayne was also in that. Do you remember Ken Wayne who played Larry Kent.
Yeah, I never liked Larry Kent too much.
No, but he had a very definite style.
Oh, very much so.
But he was the baddie, forgotten the character's name, in Smokey Dawson.
Oh, yes.
And I think the young boy in it was another wonderful radio actor, Ray Hartley.
Yes, he always had a young voice, didn't he?
Voice never broke.
As did John Hewitt.
Yes, but Hartley's voice never broke. And he used to tell the story that one day he worked a lot for George Edwards, and one day he went out with a young lady and had a big cigar and really felt as though he'd come to age. And he said he got back to Macquarie and he was again playing kids' parts. So he goes to about 10. But he was a great actor.
Here's Kevin Trask.
Peter in Smokey Dawson. Who played Jingles? He was his
offsider.
A guy
called Alan Herbert.
Alan Herbert.
Yes, Alan wasn't a big name, a very good actor, but he was in quite a few plays, and a lot of the old Celtics theatres Lux Radio Theatre. So he did a lot of plays.
I used to lie in the bath with the chip heater going and listen to the Sunday night 8 o'clock.
Really?
I'd never miss it. But we haven't spoken about Leonard Teal. Mm. Now, Leonard Teal was such a well-known figure because he played Superman and appeared in Bonington's Bunkhouse Show and lots of radio shows over the years. But you actually interviewed Leonard Teal for the book.
I knew Leonard Teal I worked for World Vision for 13 years, and Leonard Teal, another side of Leonard Teal that I think is even more important, is he was a fantastic humanitarian, and he was one of the early spokespeople that got into Kampuchea after Pol Pot. Mm. He travelled with me in Ethiopia, and it was hell and high water, dreadful. We were going into places like concentration camps where people were just literally dying, and he was just a great ambassador. So that was another side of Leonard Teal. But as an actor, well, he was superb. Began as a radio announcer in Brisbane, did a lot of very serious stuff for the ABC, and was also the star of a great serial written by Alan Trevor called Requiem for Paul Jason. And he was the star of that. But he was in hundreds and hundreds of series.
Also an Amway distributor too.
That's right.
Diamond Class.
Yes, with his beautiful wife Liz Harris.
Yes, yes. Now, one of my favourite actresses, a local one, was Patricia Kennedy. And I hope you had a chance to chat to her in her lifetime.
I did. We had a wonderful time together, spent hours talking about radio. And, of course, Patricia was known as the first lady of Melbourne radio.
Yes.
I think Dinah Shearing and Lyndall Barber had that title in Sydney. But no, Patricia was in just so many ABC plays. Mm. She was a very serious actress. She could play Shakespeare, play anything.
And she played Melba for Hector Corbett.
She did.
The voice of Melba, not the singing voice.
No, Glenda Raymond was the singing voice. And there was another singer that did Melbourne at a different stage, I think. Glenda Raymond played the young Melbourne, and the more mature Melbourne was another singer.
Suzanne Steele, maybe?
No. It's in the book anyway.
It's in the book.
But Melbourne was an absolutely incredible, courageous event. By Hector Crawford had a passion. He wanted to do it. The family, the Armstrongs, wouldn't have a bar. We won't go on to radio. Finally, he convinced them, and he broke all the rules. You normally only had a cast of five. That's all the budget would allow. He had a cast of bigger than Ben-Hur.
Are you saying Nellie's family didn't want him to dramatise it?
No, they didn't want it. Finally, he convinced them that he would do it. He would do it very sensitively, and in the end, he and the Armstrongs became very close friends.
Okay.
But it was a wonderful production. It was done in two studios. Part of it was done in the Unitarian Church in East Melbourne with choirs, a full orchestra, no records, full orchestra, full choir. Then the speaking parts were done at 3DB, because 3DB wasn't big enough to put the choir and
the thing.
So that was an incredible for its time in the late 40s.
About the time they were doing music for the people.
Exactly.
And opera for
exactly.
the people, perhaps.
So both Hector and Dorothy and Roland Strong, they did a lot. I mean, they moved into television. They did a lot for Australian artists.
You mentioned the Armstrongs. I thought Dame Nellie was from the Mitchell family.
She was, but the Armstrongs were also part of the family.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Gigi, I'd love to talk to you.
And we will get Gigi on air. I know you've been waiting forever, Gigi, but we'll get you on air to talk to Peter Philp after this.
A Pack up your bags, no time to delay. Get out and go the Castlereagh way. Blessings abound like grapes on a vine, traveling on the Castlereagh line. Coolum, Kilroy, Carrickanungra, Kooya, Kinkin, Kooparoo, Dagan, Dalveen, Darra, Delungra, Daysdale, Denman, Dunedoo. We've traveled all roads our name to enshrine in history as the Castlereagh line.
Castlereagh line would be one of the big sellers for Grace Gibson Productions.
I think you can't help thinking of Keith McGowan when you hear that music.
Because he played it twice. The biggest
seller Grace Gibson's ever had.
Yeah, is that right?
And is it true that How Green Was My Cactus has run longer than Blue Hills?
I think, well, Bruce says it has. But, you know, Blue Hills got to about 5,500. But I think this has gone well beyond that.
Is that just a 5 minute or is that
just a short one? Yes.
So it really doesn't qualify, does it?
Oh, well, it depends. Well, it depends. Do you go by episode number or actual airtime?
My serials ran 12, 15 minutes and that was really a bridge, wasn't it?
Yes.
Here's Gigi. I'd like to talk to you, Peter Philp.
Hello, Peter. Hello,
How are you?
I'm not bad. It's a long, long time since we've spoken, since the early 1970s. I used to be a regular visitor to 3KZ.
The old Brighter Broadcasting Service, eh?
Exactly, at the Trades Hall. Mm. And I knew you and Peter Philp and Tom Wall, and I used to make a nuisance of myself in the newsroom. And I happened to be there the day when the Westgate Bridge collapsed, and suddenly everyone left the newsroom to go off and get that story.
You never made yourself a nuisance. Never say that.
Thank you so much. But your book sounds magnificent, and I'm definitely going to have to get it because I absolutely love radio, have done since I was a child in the mid-50s, and a lot of the serials you mentioned I did listen to as a child. Life with Dexter was one I used to go to bed with, and the Quiz Kids. And, yeah, I've got lots of things written down here, but there's not enough time to say it. But it's so great to see you and hear you on 3AW.
Lovely to be here tonight. We're having a ball here.
Well, I sent and uploaded on the Facebook page a picture of you from the 1970s.
I couldn't believe it. When Simon put up, I said, where did you get that from? I thought it was an old sale one, but no. 3KZ. I think it was done for the listener in when my daughter was born.
Oh, okay.
Which we won't say how many years ago that was.
Well, it was from the publicity manager, Graham...
Brady.
He gave me a set of those. Oh. I paid for them.
Yeah.
And I've got everyone. I've got Peter Philp, I've got yourself.
And Peter Dight?
Peter Dight. Yeah. And I've got... I can't remember. My
Johnny Bright?
Yes, John Bright. Mm. Bill Rule. Jim
Bill Hill, Rule, yeah.
Billy Pennell. Mm. Everyone.
How
John
wonderful,
Jones,
geez.
Barry Casey.
Yes.
They're all in a frame in my bedroom, so I just raced off to the bedroom to take that picture.
Oh, lovely talking to you, Gigi.
Oh, good on you, Gigi. Lovely call. Thank you.
You talk about Barry Casey. He ran one of my favourite Grace Gibson serials, My Father's House, with James Condon.
James Condon.
What a great drama that was.
It was, and what a great actor, James Condon. Yeah.
And sadly, there's one serial you don't mention, which in the 40s, you can't mention all of them. My sister and I were just terrified by a George Edwards production set on the racetrack. It was called, on 3XY, Thundering Hooves.
Right.
It was so scary.
Well, George did so many.
And he was married to Nell Sterling.
He was.
And she appeared in his radio serials.
Yes, she did. She was frequently with him.
Yes.
In fact, they began working with I think it was George Edwards' nephew, Lionel Lunn, on 2UE in the old days when the old 2UE studios were overrun by rats.
Charming.
Pretty primitive stuff. But Simon mentioned about live radio. They used to do a live Sunday night program from 2UE, and that's where George Edwards got his start. And then he split and went to 2GB and did the famous Caesarine show that came... AW should have got it because it came from 2GB, but 3KZ got it, and it became a massive success. That's where really George Edwards began.
I just want to back up there, because we did mention about an hour ago I asked the question about what they did. Did radio serials exist in any form prior to the having the ability to record them and distribute them amongst the different stations. So they used to do them live.
And
was it sort of a network thing? Would they do it live on 2GB and 3AW would also take it, or did we our own?
They did two ways, Simon. If there was a network and if they had the sponsors, I mean, the ABC did this all the time on landline, but if there was a sponsor that paid the landline costs, they would do landline. But one of the most celebrated radio serials that really made 3XY was One Man's Family. It began in the 30s when Frank Thring Sr. was applying for a license, because 3XY came on the air. That was the last of the old traditional radio stations, 1935. And he was in Hoyts and he was in Princess Theatre. And he said, if I get the license, I'm going to have blood and flesh, real blood and flesh drama on my station. He got the license and he lived up to that promise. Mm. And one of the first things he did was to buy a very popular American series called One Man Family. And they rewrote it here and did it live. Now, it only went to Melbourne. In Sydney, John Dunn, the famous John Dunn, was working for 2SM, and they did their version up there. In Brisbane, Ron Roberts, who was the doyen of narrators, did all the narrations for Grace Gibson. He and Madge Ryan, who was a wonderful actress, they did the Brisbane version. So sometimes it went on landline, sometimes each state did their own version. Another classic was Coronets of England, again 3XY. Edward Howell, a great name from radio at AWA, did the Sydney version. So that's how they did it. They were all live, could not make a mistake. People were petrified sometimes because some of these scripts were badly done. And particularly if you work for, like, Fred and Maggie, they were actually doing it live on air when they were still being handed the scripts. Oh. So they were sight reading it. Wow. And this was comedy.
Off the
Gestetner. Right inflection had to be right.
Yeah.
And
Peter, I've got to ask you, I did an interview many years ago with Bud Tingwall, and he told me he was doing an episode of Tarzan, and Rod Taylor became ill, and he did both parts. He played Tarzan and he played his own role. Bud Tingwall was such a dynamic force in radio. During the 1950s, he did so much work. Every time I listened to the Celtics did, I could pick his voice. He was a marvellous actor, wasn't he?
Oh, he was one of the best. And again, I'm repeating myself a lot, but another great human being. He was. I only wish he was alive today, because he helped me so much do this book. No, you're right. Tingwell was one of the great ones. He started as an announcer on 2CH. And then, like lots of others, on the youth show on 2GB, the big Macquarie show with Lloyd Burrell. And then he was Ellery Queen.
Oh, was he?
Yes, he did Ellery Queen. But then Lux, he did Lux and General Motors Hour, ABC. He was a brilliant actor.
Mm.
Brilliant actor. And he speaks very highly of someone we haven't mentioned. People may not remember him. John Saul. Now, John Saul was the second Dr. Paul. There were three Dr. Pauls over the years. John Bushell was the first guy that played Dr. Paul till he went overseas. Then John Saul, and then finally Alastair Duncan, a Scot that played it for Donkeys, although you would never know he was a Scot.
I can remember Alastair Duncan was in a film play with Ray Milland here at The Princess.
Yeah.
And there I thought, there's my hero. I'm looking at Ray Milland, but there's my hero, Alastair Duncan.
Great actor.
Peter, I want to ask, again, going back to my fascination with recording and live stuff, when serials were finally recorded, able to be recorded, and they were played, was it just sort of done once and then the recordings often thrown away? Or I know that 3AW in 1957 started replaying Dad and Dave, which had been to air 20 years earlier. Was that a common occurrence? Were they repeated a lot?
Oh, yes. Superman, Leonard Teal tells the story that I think Superman went for 900 episodes, so the best part of 10 years. As soon as it finished, Macquarie started from chapter one, off they went again. No, there were lots of repeats. Dossier on Demetrius, I don't think ever, at one stage, ever got back to Grace Gibson. It went everywhere.
Oh, yes.
And a lovely story about Lindsay Hardy, Gregory Keane stories. They finally made it to the country, and 3TR were playing them, and one of the big department stores in Gippsland sponsored it. It was really big-time radio, 8 o'clock on a Wednesday night. You had to get your commercials right. You couldn't make a mistake. Fanfares, and in would come Dossier, then Deadly Nightshade, and then 26 Hours. At that stage, from Terrelgan to the border, there was only one 24-hour police station that was sale. Now, on a Wednesday night, when Dossier was on the air, the police would take all the phones off the hook because they didn't want to miss Dossier.
And, you know, I've known people to lose their jobs by playing the wrong episode. It happened to a friend of ours, Adam Voorheer, at 3AK in the 1980s. He played the same episode of Dossier on Demetrius 2 days in a row and got the sack for it, which is a bit cruel.
I'm just very glad that rule no longer applies in radio.
Now, we have to go to a break, but you'll be very pleased to know that I'm old enough to have been to the Russell Street Auditorium and watched the Caltex Theatre go to air live on Sunday night at 8, and all the actors and actresses in dinner suits and long dresses and the sound effects on the stage, a night I will never forget. It's still in the old
Russell
Street.
Miles Wright would have produced that, wouldn't he?
Yes, I believe so. And I think it might still be there, that Russell Street Auditorium.
Well, it's now is it the Kelvin Club? It's a Kelvin Club.
Well, might be. Yes. In Russell Street.
It's 23 to 11. We need to break. We'll be back with, we've got more calls for you, Peter. We've got Gail and Jean. We'll come and talk to you very, very shortly.
The story you are about to hear is true. Only the names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Dragnet!
Dragnet, the documented drama of an actual crime. For the next 30 minutes, you will travel step by step on the side of the law through an actual case from official police files. From crime to punishment. From beginning to end, the story of Dragnet.
That was the voice of Howard Craven, of course, who finished up on 2CH. We only have 10 minutes left. People are emailing me, SMSing me, phoning me in the commercial break. How can we buy this book, Drama in Silent Rooms, by Peter Philp? How do we buy it?
Well, you can buy it from, if you're in Melbourne, you can buy it online at bookstore.com. Bookpod, or easier, ring up. I like to ring up, which is 98034481, 98034481, and of course Grace Gibson. Great honour to be having my book sold by Grace Gibson. Grace Gibson, 99062244, or look, if you're online, just put Drama in Silent Rooms by Peter Philp.
Yeah,
it'll come up.
Now, we haven't talked much about playwrights. We mentioned Lindsay Hardy. My favourite would be Ross Napier. Oh. He wrote some wonderful serials, didn't he?
He did. Hardy could never write self-contained stuff. They put him on Nightbeat for a few episodes. Didn't do well.
Okay.
But Ross Napier, anything they gave him, he could do. The Castlereagh line. He did Address Unknown.
My Father's House.
He did a lot of those short, when Grace Gibson put out those 6 or 7 minute ones.
Oh, he was at his best. He wrote many episodes of The Passing Parade.
He did.
Yes. He did.
Now, one of radio's great writers, Ross Napier.
Absolutely. Glad we gave him a mention.
And Max Afford, you mentioned Max Afford.
Oh, absolutely. And now Gail's in Northern Victoria for you, Peter Philp.
Hello, Gail.
Turn your radio off, please, Gail.
Hello.
I think I've lost the plot. I've been listening too long.
How are you?
Oh, yes, I'm very well, thank you.
You're a radio drama fan?
Oh, yes, I am. I just sit out here on the veranda and listen to you guys.
What radio serial did you like?
Well, I think I've lost the plot.
You've lost the plot.
I have something to say, and I can't remember what I was saying.
Well, start by turning your radio off, because that will confuse you.
No, it's fine.
I quite like
listening to what she's saying in the background.
I don't want to hear myself twice.
I reckon you do.
Gail, do you have a question about radio serials for Peter?
Look, you guys, you know, I live up in the middle of nowhere, and it's just fantastic to listen to you.
Thank you.
And I just love it. And I did have something to say, and I can't remember what I was going to say.
Why don't we take the next call? We'll come back to you, Gail. Collect your thoughts.
Hang on there, Gail, because we're on till midnight. We'll come back and we'll get it out of you eventually. Jean's at Fountain Gate. G'day, Jean.
Oh, good evening to you, gentlemen.
G'day.
Hello, Jean.
Oh, I'm thoroughly enjoying hearing these old things. I'm an 81-year-old, and we used to listen to the radio every night. And you've mentioned one, Thundering Hooves.
Yes.
Now, I can only have flashes. Was it horse racing involved in it?
Yes, it was. It was on 3XY at 7:30 each evening, and it was a George Edwards production.
Right, and I seem to remember the music was special. Was it because it was...
Yes, the music was from a movie. It was called A Voice in the Night. Very scary music.
Right, well, that I've always remembered it, and I haven't known why.
Well, there you are. You and I are both, Gene, so we have something in common. Let's get married.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
Okay, lovely talking to you.
Good on you, Gene. Lovely call.
Good thank you, Gene.
Now, we only have 5 minutes left. In researching the book and talking to all these authors, is there some certain highlight, a meeting you had with somebody unexpectedly, something you learned you didn't know before?
Well, I think I'd like to pay tribute to these people. They were just fantastic. They made my life a joy. I had a passion to do this. But one of the most encouraging people was Beverly Dunn. Beverly just said, "This has never been done, Peter. Go for it. Anything I can do." So she gave me all the silent lines. "You ring them up," she said. Tell them I gave the numbers." And there was only one person that wasn't terribly helpful, because he said, "Look, it's all gone now. I'm a grumpy old man," and that was John Morgan. So anyway, I said, "Okay, John, we'd love to have..." No, I don't want to do it." So Beverly rang me up and she said, "How did you get on?" And I said, "Well, the only person that knocked me back was John Morgan." She said, "Leave it to me." Oh. 2 days later, she rings back and says, "Ring him back." And rang him back, good as gold. So I'd like to pay tribute to Beverly. To Lyndall Barber, we sat in the New Zealand pub, in the saloon bar, a special chair she had there. Bud Tingwell, Leonard Teal, Dinah Shearing, Elizabeth Wing, they were all great. Keith Eden invited me back for dinner. They just opened their homes up.
Yes.
And I also remember going blind, sitting in the public library under those little green lights for nearly 2 years, going through every newspaper, trying to find little bits and pieces,
In 25 years, was there a time when you thought, "I'm going to give this up"?
Yes, many times, but my wonderful wife, Nain, who is also a radio person, she said, "You owe it to these people. It's never been done, Peter. They have given their time, went up to Sydney, and I booked a motel, and they just came in like a sausage machine." No one ever said no. So, look, as I say in my dedication, my wife has been the inspiration.
Peter, how much of it was because she believed in the project, and how much of it was because she just wanted to get you out of the house?
She loved her cereals. She was a mad... In fact, coming down tonight from Fish Creek, we've been listening to Deadly Nightshade.
Oh, good. Oh, lovely. Now, listen, did you get a chance to talk to Grace Gibson when she was alive?
I did. She took me to lunch.
Oh.
Very.
A tough lady, wasn't she?
She was a tough lady, but as Bud Tingwell used to say, she kept us in the business. Even when the radio drama was folding up, she kept going. So a lot of people were saying, "Oh, we never got royalties." They were a bit critical of her, but no one else paid royalties except the ABC. But no, Grace kept the show on the road for a long time. And also Bruce, he's done a great job.
Bruce Ferrier from Grace Gibson. Yeah. And Bruce Leonard, of course, historian. Yes. And of course, many of these radio actors and actresses went on to achieve great acclaim on television, Crawford's Consider Verdict and all the cop shows, and many of them became household names on TV and on the big screen.
Well, Ruth Cracknell, one of the sad things that made me quite angry was when Ruth died, people said, "Oh, she was famous for
Mother and Son.
She did this and did everything else." No one ever mentioned one of her greatest performances ever was in White Coolies, Australian Women at War. Ruth Cracknell had a wonderful interview with Ruth, and she said, it was a most powerful thing I ever did. She said, "We were unprofessional." She said, "It was so powerful, we cried, and we had to stop the recording." So Ruth was, again, another great radio
actress. As was June Salter, of course, and John Million and all these wonderful people.
Neva Carglin, Queenie Ashton.
Yes.
Michael Pate,
well, you can go on all night.
Peter, the fact
Reginald Goldsworthy.
We extended this 1 hour special to 2 hours. It speaks volumes for your knowledge of these radio series. And I highly, because I'm a bit dyslexic, I want you to repeat the details.
Yes.
Drama in Silent Rooms. Philip has already bought 13 copies, full price, for Christmas giving. They've been signed by the author.
I want one for Christmas, Phil, if you can make it 14.
No, you put books on the shelf. You never read them, or you...
No, but I'll tell you why. I know we've got 60 seconds and we want to get another plug in. No. My thing is, Peter, I started about 5 years ago writing the history of 3AW. I've got a couple of hundred pages of documents there.
Good on you. One of the
hardest things for me is tracking down what serials were where. So I need Peter's book.
Okay, will you sign one before you go?
Yes, for sure. And, now, Grace Gibson is selling it. You can ring Grace or just look up on the internet. Just put in Drama in Silent Rooms by Peter Philp. Grace Gibson will come up. And also in Melbourne, BookPod is selling them out in Glen Waverley. And they're on the phone at 98 03 4481, or again look on the internet for BookPod and it'll come up.
And how much is the book?
It's $39.40, but they make it $39.99.
Yes. Okay.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much, Peter. Thank you, Kevin Trask, for staying back.
Thanks, Kevin.
We've got Mervyn Purvis coming up after the break. We've got the passing parade up after the news. Then it's your calls, 96900 693 radio serials. Get to it.